Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the year's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
And I'm Tosin Unifawakin.
Dwayne DeFreitas is going to be joining us a little later on. He is currently en route. This week, we'll be looking back at the year in tech, 2013. We'll discuss our favorite tech events of the past year and what we expect in the year ahead. As always, you can check out the past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our subscription link is in the right-hand sidebar. And join us on Facebook and Twitter at The Drill Down. Our show is also on Stitcher at stitcher.com, and you can search for The Drill Down there. Before we get into our year's best news stories, however, let's take a look at a few of the week's top headlines that cannot wait another week. Right off the bat, according to secret documents disclosed by whistleblower Edward Snowden, the NSA and its UK sister agency GCHQ proposed in a briefing a concerted drive to infiltrate the massive communities playing online games. The NSA document, written in 2008 entitled "Exploiting Terrorist Use of Games in Virtual Environments," stressed the risk of leaving game communities under-monitored, describing them as target-rich communications networks, where intelligence targets could, quote, hide in plain sight. If properly exploited, games could produce vast amounts of intelligence, according to the NSA document. They could be used as a window for hacking attacks, to build pictures of people's social networks through buddy lists and interaction, to make approaches by undercover agents, and to obtain target identifiers such as profile photos, geolocation, and collection of communications. According to the document, the NSA had already built mass collection capabilities against Xbox Live. Real-life agents have been deployed in the virtual realms from including World of Warcraft and Second Life. And there were attempts to also to recruit potential informants from the game's tech-friendly users. I read the actual NSA document, the briefing, and I thought this was really fascinating on two levels. First of all, it's something that never occurred to me that the infrastructure of the communication systems within these games are in effect anonymous. Other than your IP being logged in, there's no like permanent record being saved of the communication, of the person-to-person communication between players. And or in many cases, there's no record being kept of the texting as well, of the IM messaging between players in these games. So it would be like a perfect, ideal place for bad doers to convey messages back and forth between each other. And the other thing is that it also brings up the whole issue of gamers' privacy rights as well. Like now there's a whole other class of online users that have to worry about their privacy being exploited. What do you think about this, Tosin?
Well, you know what? I think it's kind of to be expected, because in the past, the agencies would use bars and back alleys and other areas for their dealings, and it only makes proper sense that it would move to a virtual haven, and more so even, you know, game community, because at that point you are, you know, not to further stereotypes, but you are looking at the more technical, knowledgeable individuals, given that, you know, they have to make sure that the game works on their system, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't find myself shocked at all to see that there would be a lot of that. I mean, case in point, do you remember Internet Relay Chat?
Sure, IRC? Sure, yeah.
Well, that I think that is also to a lesser to well, I'm, I can't say to a lesser or greater extent, but to some extent, that's also potentially a haven for that sort of activity as well.
Mm-hmm.
And anywhere that you can get, united technophiles, united people who are having a shared experience that is, tied to technology, you'll also find those who are looking to either exploit or hire them.
Yeah, I was just let me ask you, did you consider that game systems are havens for anonymous communication?
To a certain extent, not as much as, I don't think I would have forecasted this to the extent that the article discusses it, but I think it's just something that hasn't really surprised me, given what I've been in a lot of those communities. I've seen a lot of stuff that makes you think twice, but you often just shrug it off.
Mm-hmm.
And if you really think about it, a lot of the games like World of Warcraft and become much more than that. They become a full livelihood. And so I can see where it's very easy to be able to, exploit, have that sort of communication and at least feel a little bit secure and unmonitored in that facet.
I'm going to definitely have a second thought next time I go on to, like GTA 5. And I hear all the chatter between people. But, I think... This is also a report that was filed back in 2008, and the article, the Guardian article that reported this, said that there's no indication that this kind of surveillance ever foiled any terrorist plots, nor is there any clear evidence that terror groups were using these virtual communities to communicate. So this was like a preemptive exploratory strike on the part of the NSA, and who knows whether or not or how much further they followed through on this.
Right.
Okay, so moving on here. 8 top tech companies in the U.S. have asked governments around the world to reform surveillance laws and practices and asked the U.S. to take the lead. AOL, Apple, Facebook, Google, LinkedIn, Twitter, Yahoo, and Microsoft said this week that they understand the government's need to take action to protect their citizens' safety and security, but, quote, strongly believe that current laws and practices need to be reformed. This was in an open letter to President Obama and members of Congress on a newly launched website called Reform Government Surveillance. The company said that this summer's revelations, referring to the NSA leaks, of course, highlighted the urgent need to reform government surveillance practices worldwide. The balance in many countries have tipped too far in favor of the state and away from the rights of the individual. Rights that are enshrined in our Constitution, they said. The companies have outlined through the website 5 reform principles, including limiting government surveillance to specific known users for lawful purposes and greater oversight and accountability over intelligence agencies. I found this to be interesting because... you have what it feels to me like is that you have all of these companies, they're uniting against a quote common enemy in the face of the NSA, and that had there not been so many privacy violations against the companies themselves, and I'm referring to the last a couple of revelations that we heard from Edward Snowden, where we learned that the NSA was siphoning data directly from their data lines and not as a company, as an internal request. That if we had not heard about those incidents, that these companies may not be may not have banded together in what seems to be the common citizens' defense. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah. So the thing about it is, when it really comes to surveillance, and this is all, this is not just surveillance by the government, but even activities by other, you know, organizations who are, you know, trying to, you know, black hat hackers who are trying to cause malicious harm to these tech companies. What you actually really notice here in the valley, mm-hmm. is that a lot of these organizations have banded together to kind of work together, letting each other know that, hey, you know, I noticed this exploit. Hey, such and such is going on, because really they're the first line, right? Yeah. If you think about it, most of the times when anything negative happens, the government really is just there. The government and law enforcement is just there to pick up the pieces afterwards, uh-huh. and isn't really helping them in this new day and age. So it's really like, so ultimately it's kind of each man for itself, and therefore what's just been the most strategic move is to band together as a technologically community, yeah. because, you know, it's just a lot easier that way. So I, you know, given what the government has been done, given how these organizations have already had to band together, you know, this just makes sense.
I am glad that this is being done. But I can't help but think that it feels a little self-serving on the part of the companies involved.
Well, it does give them sort of that positive vibe,
sure.
externally, right? Especially in this day and age where I think a lot of consumers are there's a lot of distrust. Because if you think about it, quite a lot of those names were also on that list too. So
yeah, that's right. Google, Facebook, Microsoft, Yahoo—they were all, you know, complicit in delivering data to the NSA through formal requests.
Yeah, so I definitely see where you're coming from there, and you know, I'm sure it's both a political move, but it also is sort of, to another extent, a practical move.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
pragmatic.
So essentially what they're saying is we don't want things to get worse than they already are.
Right.
Okay, moving on here. Okay, so last week Apple unveiled iBeacon. They launched iBeacon. It's a technology that they unveiled earlier in the year during, I believe it was WWDC. It's a location-based technology to help customers find products, display product info, and provide indoor mapping services on iPhones at retail stores like the Apple Store. It's a software update to all iOS 7 devices that use Bluetooth technology. iBeacon uses Bluetooth Low Energy it allows their devices to send out location signals with almost constantly with very little battery usage. In contrast, Bluetooth allows users to send lots of data wirelessly or stream music to speakers. BLE, Bluetooth Low Energy, can only send and receive a very small amount of data. What's interesting about this is that, you know, it seems like Apple's use case for this, which is to allow people to walk into an Apple store, carry their iDevice with them, their iPhone or their iPad, and be offered some additional customer service through their iDevice when they're next to a particular product that they're looking at. It's kind of a stealthy sort of like a stealthy sort of move on Apple's part, because I feel like this is just sort of like the opening volley to a broader use for iBeacon. And some of the one of the uses that's been hinted at is near-field communication. Now, for example, Android devices already have NFC built in, NFC chips installed, but those NFC chips installed, for example, in the use of like a mobile payment, where you are paying for your stuff using your mobile device at the cash register. Mobile payment using NFC chips works only in close proximity to sensors that are used for the payments. iBeacon, on the other hand, can broadcast up to 150 feet, which in an Apple store could theoretically allow for customers to simply leave their phones in their pockets and automatically pay as they walk out the store. And this technology isn't limited to Apple stores in particular. It's any vendor that wants to use the iBeacon technology, which doesn't have to be adopted by anyone because it's already in all of basically it's in every iPhone, I think, going back to maybe 4 or 4S. It's pretty a phenomenal sort of sneaky move on Apple's part to basically flip this switch and allow this potential mobile payment system to suddenly be available to all of their users.
Yeah, currently is an advertising system. I wonder how much of it is going to be opt-in versus, you know, opt-out. Mm-hmm. Right? Because for me, most of the time, I'm one of those shoppers who does a lot of research online before I go inside, so I know specifically what I want and why I want it, and don't necessarily want, you know, me stopping at a certain item to cause my phone to start to vibrate, and therefore my watch to start vibrating as well. Go Pebble.
Right. Wasn't Dwayne complaining over the last week about how his Pebble was just over notifying him?
Yes. So that would definitely add to that.
Yeah.
I mean, I think in terms of, you know, in terms of a marketing and a product move, it's a great thing. A lot of general stores have started to try and figure out how they want to do that, you know, by making you join their Wi-Fi network and seeing if they can at least prompt you with sales in store. But now you can actually be more, you know, specific in your targeting. Potentially, you could imagine going to their grocery store, looking at a particular item and being able to tell, you know, if there is a coupon that's currently available for it.
That would be nice.
Or a coupon for anything in that aisle.
And have that coupon pop up on your mobile device when you bring it up to pay.
Yeah. We have a grocery store chain called Safeway here.
Sure.
And what you basically have your card, which is on your device, and you add coupons to your card by just finding the coupon and just adding it on your phone. So when you scan your card, that coupon gets used if you purchase that item. So you could see how that extra step in there where you'd have to find those coupons and navigate can be, you know, speeds up the process quite a lot.
Yep. I think we have just only begun to hear about iBeacon. And I think this is probably why Apple wasn't too concerned over the last couple of years about NFC. You know, Apple pundits had been asking, well, I wonder if Apple is going to incorporate NFC in any of their future versions of the iPhone. And Apple, of course, hadn't said anything one way or the other and didn't seem to be overly concerned about the fact that NFC was getting such broad adoption in Android devices. This is probably why. So they kept their cards close to the vest on this one. All right, let's take a moment to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com. Audible is the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And I'm going to talk about an Audible selection that is free. Even if you are an Audible subscriber, you don't have to use any of your Audible credits for this. It's The Secret Life of Walter Mitty by James Thurber, narrated by Ben Stiller. So this is a it's a short story. It's 15 minutes long. Secret Life of Walter Mitty wasn't a very long story to begin with. It's about a mild-mannered daydreamer who escapes his anonymous life by disappearing into a world of fantasies filled with heroism, romance, and action. So this is obviously a tie-in with the upcoming feature film adaptation of Secret Life of Walter Mitty, directed and starring Ben Stiller. So have you read this short story, Tosin?
I have not. I've been curious about it, especially coming out.
Are you an Audible subscriber?
I am not yet, but clearly thinking about signing up.
If you do, this one is free one way or the other. Even if you are not a subscriber and you want to subscribe and try out one of the free books, like this one, for example, even if you don't like the service, then you can just quit out the service and you still get to keep the book for free. You still get to keep Secret Life of Walter Mitty. To download that free audiobook, all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook, plus the 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. All right, we're going to take a little break here, listen to some music, and when we return, we'll be back with Duane DeFreitas, and we're going to talk about the best tech stories of the year. So take a listen to this and come on back.
Feeling my way through the darkness, guided by a beating heart. I can't tell where the journey will end, but I know where to start. What does the fox say?
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Tosin Anafawakin, and we are now joined by Duane DeFreitas, who is still en route back home, but he joined us via mobile for a discussion of the best tech stories of 2013, some tech fails, and what we think the future, 2014, holds for us. How you doing, Duane?
I'm in good shape. Just getting back from hanging out with some friends and family.
All right.
And excited to talk about 2013. It's a crazy year.
I think if you had to sort of rank the top stories of the year, and we're not going to rank a lot of these top stories, but you'd have to, arguably, the top story of tech story of the year, hands down, has got to be Edward Snowden and the NSA leaks that Edward Snowden facilitated. So basically, ever since the news was reported that Edward Snowden had leaked these documents out of the NSA, every week or so, I would say consistently almost every single week, there's been some new revelation about how our personal privacy has been systematically chipped away at by the NSA for years. Pretty phenomenal revelations as well.
Yeah,
I mean, this whole thing is the Snowden situation is it represents more than just hey, some guy took like Bradley Manning did some WikiLeaks stuff, and you know, it was eye opening the way that the State Department was working and so on. But Edward Snowden, he was as systematic as the NSA. When you talk about the NSA systematically chipping away at freedoms, he was as systematic when he decided he was going to take information. He not only took the information, he laid out, he told us that there was a multilateral strategy, a multilateral way of going at the what we consider rights in America in terms of our electronic privacy.
Yeah.
He laid out the idea that, you know, it's not just that we, you know, information is being taken care of in terms of our being taken in terms of like who we're calling and what we're doing. It's about everything. It's about what we're looking at. It's about who's looking at what. It's about it's almost any asset, any aspect rather, of your online life is seeking to be quantified by the government in big data. And anyone who's ever said the government isn't good at technology, they're making fun of healthcare.gov.
Sure.
It's because they didn't have the NSA working on it. Clearly, there is a level of mad genius hanging out there, in terms of scope at least, and this any means necessary focus on getting this data, quantifying this data, and analyzing this data. Edward Snowden shows how powerful data mining can be, and he gives a specter to the idea of Big Brother that we haven't seen since Orwell's 1984.
Yeah, since the theoretical literary concept of Big Brother, now we're seeing it, realized.
Yeah, and politically, everyone's afraid to touch it because, on the one hand, well, the NSA is trying to protect us, and we're still very much a post 9/11 culture. And on the other hand, politically, people are afraid to say, well, this is bad, shame on you. There's a lot of talking politically about, oh, well, you know, it has to be looked at. But the fact is, governments don't give up power. They take it and they hold it, which is why the governments, they're, by their very nature, the people who aren't really governed. And, you know, it's going to take a lot. It's going to take a lot of, if you thought that SOPA and PIPA were big deals, the internet will have to mobilize if they really want to stop this. And I'm not sure the internet really does want to stop it, you know. So Snowden, he blew it wide open.
Yeah, and the thing about this story, which makes it even deeper, is it's not as though Snowden released information on one day that gave us everything. It's been leaked out in bits and pieces here and there. And this thread has been it's been in our news for weeks. For months, actually, it's ongoing and seems to it will most likely continue going into the new year. Seems to be quite a lot more that we have not yet we have not yet determined. So,
He editorialized in a really fantastic way. The strategy he's employed, the tactics he's been using, this idea that look. I'm going to not just do some dump. We saw what happens when you do that. It's overwhelming. What I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you every week a new chapter. I'm going to unfold this tale of duplicity and deception.
And what a brilliant sort of way to keep people hanging on. There seems to be like two motivations for that. First of all, like I said, it's a great way to keep people to continue to listen to and so that the message that the NSA is chipping away at people's privacy doesn't get diluted by the fact that you get this sort of huge information dump of stuff about them. But also the other reason is that the journalistic agencies associated with releasing the information say that they need time to vet all this stuff, to sort of go through and check and double check to vet its accuracy.
There's also just the fact that as a person who's a purveyor of information, Snowden, it benefits him to release it time after time, not knowing what's coming next or knowing that there is something that could be coming next keeps the attention on the story more than it keeps it on him. In the beginning, it was all about who is Snowden, is he a traitor, is he not? The more he releases, the more the focus moves back to the NSA, and it's less about him being a traitor and more about him showing us what's going on.
Right,
that
right,
gives
right.
him more social power. That gives him more, that helps him, for lack of a better term, survive another day.
He claimed that his motive was to, that he wanted to do this to build awareness of what the NSA is doing, and the aim was for greater transparency in government amongst our data collection agencies like the NSA. And I'm excited to see this news, for better or for worse, and I hope that we keep hearing more about it, and I hope that it influences citizens and companies like the company we talked about earlier in the episode, Reform Government Surveillance Group, which is made up of the consortium of all the major tech companies out there. I hope it influences them to take action to enforce that transparency. Okay, let's move on. Tosin, why don't you tell us one of the top stories off of your list?
I guess one of the stories on my list is the change in royalty, we'll call it royalty, of Microsoft, with Steve Ballmer stepping down. I think that was something that I was not expecting to happen in 2013, and I think that kind of defined Steve Ballmer defined an era of Microsoft.
Sure.
And he definitely made some missteps in some of the things he said and some of the things he did, but still, as an overall figurehead, he's been there since Steve Jobs, right? He's been this present who is shaped
Bill Gates.
This Bill Gates. Thanks for the correction. He's been this presence who's really shaped the company and shaped the technological landscape, to tell you the truth. And now that he's going away, we have a shift in the expectations of Microsoft and maybe in how they position and see themselves in the future. So as they search for a new CEO and a new head, what Microsoft becomes now is really up for questions, up for grabs.
I think that Steve Ballmer is, in many ways, the Henry VIII of Microsoft. By that I mean, Henry VIII was the last truly absolutist ruler of England.
Uh-huh.
He decided that he was going to separate from the Pope. He was going to make his own churches. He was going to, what he wanted was done because he said it, right? And then thereafter, with Elizabeth and everybody else, Parliament stepped in, and there was more of a judicious constitutional process to, moving forward. When the crown tried to grab that kind of power back, then Henry VIII power back, they got their head. The king got killed, and all that. I think that Steve Ballmer is the last person, because he does come from the Gates era, and he was ordained by the founder. I think he's going to be the last person who has the ability to say, no, we're not doing this definitively. I don't care what data says. I don't care what seems reasonable. This is what I want. We're going to do it exactly my way. Right. While I think that CEOs will wield considerable power at a place like Microsoft, no doubt, I do think that there's going to be a more measured look at things and a focus on moving in the types of directions that allow them to stay nimble and relevant, because relevance is what I think most of us would say Microsoft struggles with. they have products that we do enjoy. And at the same time, you just have to question some of the innovation. Steve Ballmer oversaw the destruction of the Danger products, the Sidekick, because of a strange need to move from Java to .NET. He oversaw the Zune and you know, the fact that Zune could have been more than it is and it ended up failing. And I think most notably, he oversaw Windows Mobile, or Windows Phone as we refer to it now. And Windows Phone is a system, Windows Mobile, Windows 8, all these things, they're all related. And Windows Phone especially is a system that that was not focused on by Microsoft in an age where everything went mobile. So we're going to see some changes that reflect, frankly, reality. The reality distortion field era is over, between Ballmer and Jobs being no longer being in power at these massive companies. I think there's going to be more focus on vision, mm-hmm. based on extrapolation of available and existing trends.
Also, let's remind people that Microsoft still doesn't have a successor to Steve Ballmer. That's still up in the air. And we really do not know for sure why Steve Ballmer stepped down. Like, we don't know what the...
I think he stepped down because of the writing's on the wall. His leadership has not been fruitful to Microsoft and shareholders. Before shareholders, you know, force him to abdicate, he abdicates himself. And so the idea that he can spend a year looking for his, you know, looking for the Arthur that can pull the stone out of the sword out of the stone is going to be really helpful, because they're going to, again, have a measured and focused process where they get some consensus between the board and the current CEO about who is fit to lead this company into the next generation. And whether that's Steven Eloff or someone internal to Microsoft or someone who doesn't have any Microsoft chops at all, whether they say, hey, look, we're going to like hijack Marissa Mayer from Yahoo. Who knows? But they're going to go through a real change of power that is going to signify something more than the cult of personality that shows up around founders. Microsoft is moving away from the founder space and into the space of this company that's supposed to have a legacy that lasts indefinitely. And while we've looked at, you know, with Tim Cook, there was definitely a kingmaker situation from Steve Jobs, just like how Bill Gates created a kingmaker situation for Ballmer. Microsoft is just one generation past that, and they need to really evaluate who's going to be the right person. They have to bring them from outside. The company is strong enough, has a brand that's strong enough to be brought from outside. That's what they have to do.
Dwayne, do you want to pull a top story of 2013 off your list?
Yeah, sure. In less grim news than the fall of leadership from Microsoft and Edwards and NSA, like I say, we've seen some tech companies that are on the rise, that are moving forward in ways that are really exciting, and I think Amazon's one of them. So basically, these are unrelated. Well, they're related because they're all brought by Amazon. But frankly, in Amazon this year, Amazon.com. They hit their third generation of tablets, which have begun to rival the iPad in a serious way. The Kindle Fire HDX tablets are, you know, everything from the way they market them with commercials that go right up against the iPhone to the iPad to what's possible and the amount of app services and everything you can get right there from the devices. They're really mature. So we've got a second mature tablet maker out there, and it isn't Google, it's Amazon. Then we've got... you've got their other products like the Mayday service on the Kindle HDX tablets.
Right.
Is a brand new way of dealing with customers' needs. Why can't you just hit a button and get somebody? That's what a service company would do. And that's one of the differences between an Apple, which is a hardware and software company, and an Amazon, which is a products and services company. Amazon's like, yeah, we'll have a person. We'll have a happy person just waiting there to answer your question. And help you find the products you need or whatever you need. So I think Mayday is, it's very, I mean, Mayday is like that Star Trek, The Next Generation kind of, let me hit a tap of a tablet. I'm talking to somebody who's helping me take care of business. I'm not just kind of waving and showing pictures of my kids on FaceTime. So I think that's pretty, it's pretty big. They hit their Generation 6 Kindle, the normal dedicated e-reader. And, you know, gone are the days where you have to worry about an e-reader. Do you get the Sony? Do you get the Kobe or Kobo? Do you get the Nook? They're all done. It's the Paperwhite that is the e-reader today. So they've claimed ascendancy. They've taken out the competition in that respect. And then they've got the crazy other things that they've done. The announcement that they're going to be working with the U.S. Postal Service in order to deliver on Sundays. The original productions that have come out of Prime Instant Video, like Alpha House and Betas.
Sure.
So they're kind of going right up against another competitor, Netflix, and saying, we're going to create our own content then as well. It's brand new content. We're not taking content from old media and bringing it to new media. We're going to make new content about stuff we know. Alpha House and Betas are, you know, they're about topics that are familiar to Amazon. You guys should check them out if you haven't.
The more important thing is that they were crowdsourced. They were chosen by Amazon Amazon viewers as opposed to creative executives.
Right. So, I mean, Amazon and Netflix both have, they're both using data effectively in their own way, whereas Netflix is saying, okay, people who like this, like these two things, you know, they like political dramas, they like Kevin Spacey, whatever, let's get these guys together and make a show. That's one way to use the data. And Amazon's like, well, let's throw a couple things out there and see what sticks, which has been their MO in other technologies. So yeah, they're using multiple new ways of putting together this new content and making instant video something to check out. Because for a long time, instant video was like, oh, almost everything's on there is on Netflix, so why would I even go over there? And I'm dialed into Netflix already. Well, now there's some compelling reasons to. And then finally, the announcement of Prime Air, recent as a, right, you know, a fortnight ago, 2 weeks ago. The idea that they want to have moonshot projects on the Google level. Google driving cars, Google Glass, Prime Air. Now, when you think about the driving car thing, you're kind of like, wow, that just seems so out there. That'd be so cool, but it just seems so out there. I don't know if I'm comfortable with it. When you think about the Google Glass thing, you're like, wow, that'd be cool, but it looks really strange, and like you can't wear it in restaurants, and I don't know how I feel about the whatever. With Prime Air, it's kind of like, that actually seems doable, but it's still a huge leap forward in terms of what's possible, right? So they, it's interesting, measured, focused, interesting, you know, they have measured and focused responses to their various competitors that all tie directly into their core focus, which is delivering products to people, products and services to people. So Amazon, I think, in terms of like a top story, this has been one of the years of Amazon. I think Amazon has taken the cake this year as a top tech company.
Sure. I'm going to spin off of what you said about mentioning Amazon's original video productions and say that one of my favorite stories of 2013 is basically the ascent of Netflix. You know, at the I think last year we were talking about Netflix as potentially going away forever, and Netflix's CEO at the time had made some serious missteps with the company, least of which was wanting to spin off the company into two different sub companies, Netflix and then the one whose name I can't remember offhand that would just be about DVD delivery.
That's
Quixter, right? But
right.
But since then we've seen quite a turnaround for Netflix.
Netflix has rebounded.
Yes,
Netflix has rebounded. It has it's gotten some customer appreciation back. It's gotten over. I mean, in addition to what you were talking about with the Quixter and Netflix, they the price went up significantly for a lot of people.
Sure.
A lot of people went from paying, you know, $9.99 to $16.99. They didn't communicate effectively why that had to happen. And
right.
They had good reasons for it. Sending stuff in the mail is more expensive than streaming stuff, which is why they wanted people to pay more for it. So Netflix got over a significant hump that is very hard for a technology company to do, that they got over a big PR debacle.
Yep.
So, yeah, I think you're right. That is a very worthy mention.
And look what they've done in the last year. They've created like at least three original series, of which at least two of them have been nominated for Emmys.
What are the three series, Andy? Why don't you lay those out?
It's House of Cards, Orange is the New Black, and I'm drawing a blank on the one that was created by
Lilyhammer?
No, it was after Lilyhammer. It was the horror one. But yeah, Lilyhammer is worth a mention as well. I will come up with the other one in a second.
Okay, well, that doesn't matter as much as the idea that they're not just making and distributing content.
Yeah.
I mean, we say it all the time on the show, or at least I say it, they need to become HBO before HBO becomes them in terms of the quality of content. But they're at a place where they're really chasing that down and getting it done with nominations for Emmys. In addition to setting a new paradigm for the consumption of this media. They're not, you know, with the Amazon shows we discussed earlier, Amazon's releasing them week by week by week to keep you getting on Prime Instant.
Yeah.
Netflix is releasing things season by season so that you can binge watch a runner up for the word of the year.
Yes.
Which was admitted into the dictionary this year, this idea of binge watching.
Now, the concept of binge watching a series is not new to Netflix, certainly.
It's not new to anything. Ever since DVD sets came out.
Sure. But the idea of binge watching a first run series is unique to Netflix.
Right. The release of the series, or the release of the season, is absolute. They look at TV as consumers have begun to look at TV, which is one large piece of media to be consumed in chapters as one would a book.
Yep.
But to be consumed without interruption.
Or at the viewer's own pace.
Right. Which video on demand has done for some cable companies.
Sure.
But frankly, it's this idea that you don't have to everything from not having to fiddle with a disc. We just did those four episodes, go get the next disc out, I gotta finish watching the season of 24. To being able to, you know, all the pleasure of Netflix resuming where you left off, whatever, all that stuff is there. But, you know, you're getting this new stuff. And when it gets released, instead of going to the water cooler and talking about this episode or that, you have to check with people now. Spoilers have become a real thing. How far have you gotten? Can I talk to you about this? And the social pressure then becomes not, oh, I got to catch up on that episode, but, oh, I got to catch up on that series. I got to rush and watch it. Which I think on some level may be a better thing in terms of people getting out and doing things, because you're going to eat up a TV show in a weekend, but that's whatever hours. Let's call it, you know, 10 hours of time. You're going to eat that up.
Uh-huh.
But in the next couple weekends, you're like, I'm TV'd out. I watched a lot of TV. I watched the whole show. It was good. For the next couple weekends, I'm going to go running and skiing and doing whatever, because you're kind of just sick of.
But Dwayne, there's so many shows you still need to watch.
By the way, Hemlock Grove is the name of that other series. And then let's not forget that they brought back Arrested Development.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other really remarkable thing is all the deals that they've been able to win out. I think, got some more Disney shows.
That's right.
As well as they also made that large Marvel deal that we will potentially see and hear more about down the future. So,
In a related story, another big story, to jump what Tosin said, and to actually move from Netflix into a wider field, we've seen old media get lifted by new media. This is the classic example of it is Arrested Development coming back because they knew the people were there. They used the data to show people are watching this show. This show did not not end well, people really want more out of the show. And being able to do that, to serve the fans, albeit not in the way that the fans remember it, just controversy there. But Netflix, among others, has taken old media and given it new life through their format. And that's that. I think that is something that I think we can all agree is huge. There are other companies that have done this too. There's Kickstarter and Veronica Mars. Basically putting together Veronica Mars movies funding, or at least showing that people are interested by using Kickstarter to get enough attention and backing for studios to say, okay, we can put this together, we can do this. And then there's the rumors about Heroes being bought by Microsoft so that it could be an Xbox exclusive.
The series, Heroes, the old NBC series from a couple
years
ago?
I mean, it's not that old.
A couple years ago.
It's an NBC series. And all throughout April and May this year, the news, whether, you know, everything from tech news to entertainment news to NPR, reported that there were at least talks about Heroes coming back as a Microsoft Xbox exclusive series. And even if that doesn't happen, it shows that there is this movement where new media is using old media to get eyes and attention. And also to allow that the culture that is surrounding this old media to once again thrive. So, we're seeing an interesting confluence of new and old media in order to bring back what Kevin Spacey calls story to people who are in need of it.
Right. Regardless of the medium, regardless of the delivery method. That speech by Kevin Spacey was just so on the nose, like so on the money. We'll have to relink to that again in the show notes, because it was such a terrific little speech that just said everything that you needed to know about the current state of entertainment. Moving on, Tosin, why don't you pick something else from your list?
So one of the big stories that was pretty large for me was the announcement that Disney was purchasing Lucasfilm. And I recall all the outrage that erupted on the internet and the both the nerd pleasure as well as nerd concern. But I think the reason why this made my list is truly because of what Lucasfilm represents. It's not only what you may know from Star Wars and all the Star Wars related things, but
yeah, Tosin, before you go on, let's just ask: this is a science fiction copyright change. Why do you think this is a tech story?
So, why this is in particular a tech story is, Lucasfilm is not just Star Wars. Lucasfilm also involves Industrial Light and Magic and all the innovation that they've brought to both. To movies, to shows, to entertainment, really. It's if you walk down the line and see all the various implementations that they've designed that have been used in films such as Ghostbusters or even the Die Hard trilogy, Iron Man. It would be a shame not to add this here, because now Disney has that entire IP, that entire workforce behind them, and we get to see what sort of innovation they choose to bring along. So I think this has a deeper through line than just Star Wars, and affects a lot of other properties, a lot of other entertainment things that we, as the tech lovers out there, really enjoy. And what's actually very interesting. I had the pleasure of having a discussion with individuals at Lucasfilm, and one of the things that they reminded me of is a lot of the technology that you see out in mainstream, that are in your computers, graphics cards, that are even in consoles, originally were technology marvels of the entertainment industry. That they were just able to make cheaper and more affordable and bring eventually to the, to your home theater, to your to where you live or even places that you work.
So basically, you're saying that these the technologies that, you know, when a company like Industrial Light and Magic needs a solution in order to bring a visual effect forward, they've got to work with companies like Silicon Graphics and so on to make these fantastic devices that are going to allow them to render CGI or do whatever.
Exactly.
That is, for lack of a better term, trickled down into our, you know, our technology, into you know, the stuff that we're using on our computers, the graphic cards, the television sets that have you know, great lighting and pixels and the 3D technology. And that's a lot of what Disney's picking up, that they're, it's kind of like an acqui-hire of the knowledge and know-how to get visual awesomeness done in film, which frankly could be, if it's applied to you know, to all of what Disney has, especially the live action stuff, you know, Disney could have a new golden age, not unlike what we saw when you know, Beauty and the Beast and the Little Mermaid and those guys were out.
At the very least, Disney's got a lot to offer with the IPs of Marvel and Star Wars now. Okay, so let's move on here. You know, I'm going to go next. I'm going to say Google Glass. Now, Google Glass, we had just sort of heard like the barest inkling of last year. But this year was really the year for Google Glass. And even though it's still a, you know, a sort of a vaporware technology, we still haven't seen it rolled out to the consumer level. We did see a lot of people using Google Glass, and we got to sort of see the potential of where that technology can go. In the wake of Google Glass, a few other augmented reality headsets have emerged as well. And I think now we definitely see that that there will be a world that has Google Glass or some form of that technology in it in the near future. It's no longer sort of pie in the sky, like blue sky concept. It's now something that people are not only preparing for, but now we've finally got people setting legislation around it, where we had places, public places, that ban Google Glass from people from using Google Glass in them, and states that want to ban the use of Google Glass while driving. So I think a Google Glass is a technology that that really came into its own this year.
Yeah, you know what? I think I agree with you there. Now, as far as how effective the application is of you know, eyewear that you have, you know, that's still to be determined. But now that Google Glass is in there, there are other people who are trying to get into that same sort of market. Some of which are even trying to specialize as well for, you know, medical circumstances. But I think it's definitely here to stay, as well as, I think, as well as other wearable tech.
I mean, there's definitely a wearable tech revolution happening in 2013.
Yep.
Of that, I can, you know, I think we have no doubt. I do not think that Google Glass is worthy of a top tech story by itself. I mean, ever since 2012, guys, I've been saying this. Google Glass has always been more marketing than it has been technology.
But, you know, at the very least, it's an indicator of the wearable tech slash quantified, not so much quantified self in the case of Google Glass, but the wearable tech revolution.
Yeah, and who knows? You may start seeing a lot more of those in your neck of the woods. I know I'm a little special because living in the Valley, you know, I see Google Glass almost every single day, especially, you know, at conventions and other sort of things. And I've tried it as well, but who knows? Maybe it will spread out from this small pocket we have to the other regions of the world.
Yeah, I mean, I just feel like Google Glass, it was kind of, because it was rolled out to what you might call technorati,
sure,
it became more of a status symbol of a wannabe technology aristocrat class than it became a technology that is a scion of the future.
Interesting.
I don't think that Google Glass, I don't think that Google Glass is worthy of a top tech story this year, because I don't think Google Glass is worthy technology, at least right now.
So
I think it was so much more on hype than it was on actual serviceable, usable tech. And when we talk about wearable technology, when we talk about and what that does, that inexorably leads us to the quantified self. Wearable
technology. So I think you're talking about – so let me just make sure I'm clear here. When you mean Google Glass doesn't deserve a top spot, you mean Google's implementation of wearable technology, not wearable technology as its own, be it, you know, eyewear
exactly.
Or – okay.
Exactly. Right. I think Google Glass itself is not worthy of a top spot necessarily. But, I mean, that's part of the great debate we have on the show, right?
Sure.
I think when it comes to wearable technology, you know, that is – the wearable technology revolution has enabled this quantified self thing that we keep on mentioning ancillarily. Wearable technology is big this year. We've got the Pebble showed up, right? The watch that gave Kickstarter, that really put Kickstarter on the map mm-hmm. in terms of, you know, mass market appeal for something new and hot. And that's where I think – that's probably where I think I get some of the upsetness I have surrounding Google Glass exists. This idea that Kickstarter allows for amazing things like the Pebble Watch to show up and everyone can have it. All you have to do is back it. If you back it, you will get it. And yeah, there's a certain tech culture geekiness that like, oh, I knew about it, you know, before whatever. But there wasn't a restriction on who could have it and who couldn't have it. Whereas the Google Glass, like, we're giving 15,000 away or however many away to the people we think are worth it. And that I think is against what, frankly, Google, which is democratize the internet via search, does.
But now, also keep in mind that it's still a beta technology. It's not ready to roll out to the consumer yet.
That's fine, but if there were a Kickstarter for something like Google Glass and they could get it to a price of around $700, maybe they can do that, then there'd be plenty of people wearing it. And like, yeah, there'd be some culture stuff there too, but it's not like it's backed by Google, as Google has chosen you. Google has dubbed you a knight of glass, which is a problem. When we look at other wearable stuff, we've got the rumored Apple iWatch, right? We've got the M7 chip from Apple, which is all about, you know, you keep a phone in your pocket, we're going to track your steps, your movement, your activity. You've got the Samsung Watch, the Galaxy Gear. You've got the Fitbit relaunched itself this year. At first, you had like the Fitbit Ultra or the One and the Aria, the scale. But now you've got the Fitbit Flex. You've got the Fitbit Force, and there's the smaller Fitbit, the non-rechargeable battery Fitbit that allows basically anyone who's interested in doing quantified self to get into it with this tight pedometer that costs, you know, something like $59 or $49 or whatever. So you can really get into the quantified self movement with this really tiny wearable tech. Obviously, you've got Nike, and Nike relaunches Plus stuff as well. But what we're doing with this wearable tech is not unlike the Kindle, which is in many ways trying to replace books. This is technology that it has a focused purpose. And what it does is it tries to quantify your movements, your activities, so that you can understand yourself from what you actually do vis-a-vis information and data, and not what you think you do. Oh, I think I went to the gym enough this week. Oh, I think I worked out enough this week. Oh, I think I did this. Now it'll tell you, no, I mean, maybe you didn't. Maybe you didn't get as far. And the tight thing about it is that these devices have extraordinary, with the exception of Galaxy Gear and Google Glass, they have extraordinary battery life. You're wearing a Pebble. You've charged it up once during a week. You're wearing a Fitbit. You've charged it up once in 2 weeks. Now, the M7 chip is not a thing on its own, but what Apple's done here is created a chip that allows you to capture all this information without having any extra hardware. And the interesting thing about it is that its whole design is set up to save battery on your phone. So these background apps like Map My Run and stuff aren't mm-hmm, trying to mm-hmm. like access your accelerometer and gyrometer every single moment of every single day, running your battery down. Or you don't need you don't need like a GPS running to tell you your distance and everything, because the M7 all pulls that for you. The apps can just jump in there and, you know, do what they do, which is apply that information to whatever UI or system you need. So we've really got this kind of movement to say the technology is getting smaller and it's getting focused, and that focus is helping us in many ways be more active. And to go back to the whole Android-based eyewear thing, there are a couple pairs of snow goggles now, $650 a piece, $450, whatever, and they're called, they use this module called the Mod Live. And what it does is it quantifies speed, how high you are, you know, your altitude, and other things like that as you ski. It's not obviously as robust as Google Glass because it's kind of read-only capturing data.
Sure.
Google Glass's power is that you can talk to it, and which is phenomenal and exciting. But there is a market for the ability to track what you're doing so that you can look at yourself and get more out of yourself.
Absolutely. I think that's what you'd say. No discussion of wearable tech in 2013 can be complete without at least mentioning the Oculus Rift and the CastAR project that the Jerry Ellsworth and Rick Johnson, who were formerly of Valve, have started on Kickstarter.
Yeah, I mean, these projects are also great. They're not so much they're not directly tied to the idea of quantified self, which is kind of like fitness based right now. But I think we'll actually move into what you've done in video games and everything. Video games have been about quantified personifications for a very long time, right? Computer technology has been. A while ago, you used to be able to tell, not so long ago, you used to be able to tell how many miles your mouse has moved throughout the life of a particular installation of Windows. That is quantified self. The idea that you can, your game console will track how much time you're using it, what you're using it for, and how you're doing it, and allow you to gain access to that information. That's the big deal here. It's not just some company saying, oh, we're going to take these stats and figure out a new ad campaign. They're allowing you to gain access to that information. And I think the Oculus Rift is going to do that. We're going to see a movement toward one of Andy and I's favorite books in 2012, Ready Player One. This idea that you can immerse yourself in a virtual space with the Oculus Rift or these Valve technologies, and it's wearable tech, and it becomes an extension of yourself and doesn't get in the way. You don't have to pull it out like a phone. You don't have to pull it out like anything else. It's just there, ready and waiting for you. That's what's so tight about it.
Or we may also see the rise of motion sickness medicine sales in 2014.
Yeah, Dramamine just might skyrocket. Or maybe Dramamine might go away as people are raised with the ability to manage their inner ear better. Because in their youth, they're making use of these devices, you know?
Superhumans are coming.
Whether it's a superhuman thing and anything. I know that, for instance, I never get sick on boats or roller coasters or, you know, I don't get vertigo when I play video games or wear, like, HUDs. My girlfriend's the opposite. You put her in a car and ask her to read, she's like, oh, I'm all turned off. I think that's more a matter of training than it is a matter of innate ability or whatever. I had to dance a lot when I was a kid. I was like an off-Broadway, modern and jazz dancer. And you need to focus on spot. You learn techniques. You learn techniques to not get dizzy. And that becomes great when you begin snowboarding. You learn techniques not to lose your balance. And I think that's going to happen on some level. That can be applied on some level with these new technologies. We can get a better physical person out of some of this stuff that we've considered long the province of couch potatoes.
Tosin, let's. How about another one from your list?
Yeah, so moving away from quantified self, one thing that was actually pretty remarkable this year is Bitcoin hit $1 billion in terms of valuation. Mm-hmm. I cannot tell you the last time where we've had another currency make quite a large wave within the ecosystem. And a lot of actually legitimate companies started accepting Bitcoin as methods to purchase goods from them. So I think this was the rise of Bitcoin, and we'll see how long this lasts. But it leads you to it kind of shows that, you know, the currencies of old may not be the only way. right?
Yeah.
It's really interesting. It's sort of bringing an open source perspective to something that's always been so closed and draconian and governed and regulated. And
well, it hasn't always been. I think Bitcoin is actually a movement to a time before our current types of currency. When gold was the piece of value that we used, we assessed value much in the way that Bitcoin is assessed because of the amount of because of the quantity of the actual currency, Bitcoins in this case, or gold back then. It had value, and that value allowed us to purchase and move things around. Bitcoin's ascendancy is, I think, because it's so much more understandable than some of the currencies that are out there. I mean, the 21st century has been replete with currency changes. The euro took over, you know, the continent of Europe and threw out a whole bunch of currencies based on individual countries and how they run themselves. And now it's based on, like, what Germany can bail out, just, you know, to simplify it and not actually be accurate. to say that, that is to say, the euro makes it far more complicated to understand what the value of something is, because a certain – imagine if the U.S. had so many – had X amount of states that kept on being underwater and bankrupt, and the federal government had to bail them out, except there is no federal government. So if Kansas goes bankrupt, the state of New York has to bail it out, or vice versa. That's what's happening with the EU, and it makes currency a difficult thing to figure out in terms of, like, the value of the euro. Like, how do I assess it? Do I assess it based on the strongest state, in this case Germany, yeah, or do I assess it on the strongest state minus the weakest states? It's very confusing. Bitcoin is clear. There are X amount of Bitcoins in the world, and the fact that they haven't, they, you know, they don't get hacked or they don't do whatever, this shows the confidence in them, and that's where they get their value from. Bitcoins continue to come. They're going to continue to come out of the ether as people mine them. And mining operations get more and more sophisticated every moment of every day, expanding the money supply, but at a rate that doesn't cause inflation to happen. This is a fantastic system, and I'm interested to see. And we were talking about Amazon earlier. When a company like Amazon decides that they can take on Bitcoin, there's going to be some serious legislation, and there's going to be a crisis among governments about the fact that they can't control the money supply. Bitcoin was used for nefarious purposes at the beginning of 2013 and is now being used for legitimate purposes today. If any of you have ever read the Tech War novels by William Shatner, our favorite Star Trek captain, or whatever, you see, or like even watch Babylon 5, you see that the world is running what they call credits. Bitcoin is the beginning of that system. And whether Bitcoin survives as it is or gives way to a more international currency later, that's kind of like backed by governments and stuff, I don't know. I know that the governments of the world are going to want to regulate it because they can't control it. And without control, they simply, I mean, the world falls away from government and into, you know, oligarchy. Mm-hmm. So there's that. But it's going to be interesting to see how Bitcoin maneuvers in 2014. But even with its you know, quote unquote catastrophic fall after its dip, really after the fall of some of the nefarious uses of it, you know, drug selling and so on and so forth, right. Bitcoin has been resilient, and I think that we can look at this as definitely a watershed moment in technology and the normal, regular, real world, and how they're used together in order to
legitimization of cryptocurrency.
Exactly. Well, yeah, sure. Cryptocurrency as being useful in meat space. Hotels are taking it, you know. And when an Amazon takes it, we're going to see the world change.
Virgin Galactic accepts it, as well as there were some auto dealer that said they would accept it for Teslas as well, too.
Right.
Yeah, well, I mean, look who they're targeting. Virgin Galactic.
Yeah.
Virgin Galactic is a company that I don't think many people know about, but I mean, that's Richard Branson's vehicle for getting people in space. That's a very geeky company. Tesla,
sure.
You know, another, you know, geeks have been following Tesla for years upon years upon years. These are companies that are geeky. These are companies that are approaching the tech space, that are, you know, deeply enshrined in the tech space with a currency that's also deeply enshrined in the tech space.
Yeah, so, I mean, a lot of those top companies like, you know, Reddit or Or even Mega. Would be one of those companies to do that. Have started, you know, accepting Bitcoin, and I think that's kind of that trickle down. We'll see what happens when Amazon says, "Hey, we take Bitcoin." We'll see what happens.
Moving on, I'll take one here, and this is the last one that I have on my list for the top story of 2013. It's not every year that you have a new game console coming out. In fact, I think the last time that we had a new console, well, technically it was the Wii U, which was a couple of years ago. Last year at this time.
A new generation.
And we have two of them emerging at the same time, the Xbox One and the PS4. And consumers were split between them. And we had a genuine console war this year, where we hadn't had one in years.
I think we had the opening shots of a console war. I think it's going to go on throughout 2014. Yeah. The chips have not fallen yet. People who have been traditionally on the PlayStation side are thinking about the Xbox and vice versa. We've got the beginning of Generation 8, and if Generation 7 is anything to show us, you know, Generation 7, which lasted for 7 years, we could be looking at the beginnings of, frankly, not the better part of, but a full decade of console domination by Xbox One and PS4.
Yeah, in my personal opinion, I think that we've reached a plateau. We really have, because I haven't seen anything. I think perhaps the next revolution in console. Basically, the next console war is going to be dominated by companies who have realized that perhaps the best console is just a your own sort of home-built PC. Like, I think the Valve box may be the next new...
Wow, you're saying that there could be a reversal away from the PC, which really ran the gaming space in the early 2000s, back to the console, which ascended in 2000. And moved into dominance in around 2005 with the seventh generation. You're saying that there could be a movement back toward the PC for people who are hardcore into consoles.
That's right.
Into games.
That's right.
And wow,
if not the PC proper, the a consoles that are effectively PC. Because actually, you know, the Xbox One and the PS4 are effectively the same. They're more or less the same underneath the hood. Of course, they both have sort of DRM restrictions that disallow interoperability between them, but effectively they're the same.
But I think there's a big – I don't know that consoles – I don't see consoles going away for one reason. The seventh generation showed that you can have a piece of hardware that is 7 years old, almost 8 years old, that is really effective at delivering content.
Sure.
And the power is in the software. When you look at a game for the PS3 or the Xbox 360 in the year 2007, and you look at one now in the year 2013, it's the same exact hardware running far more efficiently with better rendering. You know, the software engineers have figured out how to get the most out of their hardware, and that's what consoles offer. PCs have also always offered the best of breed hardware at the quickest turnaround.
But if you've seen any of the actual games. You know, I've seen comparisons of games that have been released for these next generation consoles compared to the last generation, and it's diminishing returns.
Well, I think you can say that because the people who are coding these games for the new consoles, they're only here in the beginning, right?
Yeah.
Like what you're seeing is the power of a new console, and not the power of a seven years of experience of code. When you take a look at the original PS3 and Xbox games, let's get, like, you know, Halo 2 or whatever, or Halo 3, I think it was, that came out on the Xbox 360, and compare it to the new Halo in terms of games, in terms of, like, you know, what it looks like. You'll see a comparative time. Let's look at whatever they were releasing, you know, 6 months in to the Generation 7 consoles versus whatever was being released 6 months into the Generation 8 consoles. There's more than one factor of hardware working there. The big thing about these consoles is going to be the business relationships they make. Microsoft has already shown that it has a phenomenal ability to create partnerships with businesses that have content that people want to see. regardless of what happens with Heroes, you know, you can link up to your Comcast and you can see ESPN content. You can see other content right there on your Xbox out the gate. And Xbox One is taking that to the next level. The reason it's called an Xbox is because it's the mathematical unknown of X. It can do anything. It can be anything. Mm-hmm. And it's that box under your console. Sony's going to have to play that game. Now, I think a lot of people would say when it comes to the 360 and the PS3, the PS3 was far more of an entertainment station in terms of, you know, it played Blu-rays out the gate. And the Generation 7 was the age of Blu-rays. Blu-rays are not diminishing, I don't think, yet in terms of sales directly. But, you know, we're quickly seeing high-res stuff, especially as a big Blu-ray owner, as big of a Blu-ray yep. owner as you are, moving toward the downloading, ultraviolet, and so on and so forth. So we're going to see Sony have to play the game with Microsoft about how to make that console so much more than the gaming console. Whereas, which was interesting, because Sony has leaned into the gaming community. We built this for the gamers, right? Whereas Microsoft has leaned away and being like, this is for everybody. You don't want that console. You want ours because ours is is for everybody, and it plays really great games too. And the interface is all verbal and you can speak to it and everything, whereas Sony's is definitely not that. So they've got different strategies, but in the end, they've got to chase one another down feature by feature. And I think Microsoft, with its built-in Super Kinect functionalities and the voice activation, may win the day, at least in the beginning, because of that. When it comes to general audience, well, Sony might get the gamers out the gate. Yeah. And then you have the question of, if Sony gets the gamers, does that mean more exclusive third-party titles for Sony games, which you know, further diverges the space? There's just so much we don't know.
Yeah, and won't know for like at least 6 months.
Yeah, 6 months we'll have a better indication. But I think that it's a whole new space right now, yeah. with the focus being on how can we get more eyeballs on this.
I think what mm-hmm. we'll have to really focus on is once you get all the people who are diehards, right, who know I want this particular system, I'm going to be an early buyer. And when you get into the less informed people, the people who don't really follow the consoles and are more just interested in a new entertainment system, is it, you know, will they be willing to spend that extra money for the Xbox One? Will, like, what sort of things will factor in terms of where their purchase goes to? And I think it's at least going to be exciting to see, you know, what ends up happening with the game space, because given now that that Steam is going, that Valve is going to be taking a play at this whole market, are we seeing more of a convergence of you know, everything coming to PC? I mean, if you really look at the hardware of a lot of these machines, they are now a lot closer to PCs mm-hmm. than they used to be in the past. And that's why
you... That's true, but the difference is they're not going to change. The thing about the PC space is that I built my rig in 2013, and I'm going to swap out this piece or that piece in 2014 to get that much more ounces of juice out of it.
Right. So I'm not saying that
the static nature of it is what's keeping it for this, a console.
Right, so I don't think the console – I don't see the console market ever dying, but I see this convergence maybe will allow developers to have an easier time making things available for every platform, right? So you have less of the so-called exclusives.
Yeah, I mean that'd be great. I think that they are incentivized. Just like how, you know, when you hop on the App Store on an iPad or an iPhone, the featured stuff on the iOS store,
yeah,
the iOS App Store – that featured stuff tends to be stuff that's only available on iPhone, right? Especially when the 5-year anniversary showed up for the App Store or whatever, for the iPhone or whatever. It was like, these are the greatest apps ever, and they happen to not be necessarily the greatest apps, but the greatest apps that were exclusive to iOS. Sony and Microsoft are going to play that game too. They have to differentiate themselves from one another on titles as well as amenities. I think it's interesting that Microsoft – essentially, you know, despite wanting the Xbox 360 to be a great all-around console and buying all that content, they lost on a big piece. They lost on HD DVD. They right. lost it. And this new device that they have, the Xbox One, is a show of that loss, with Blu-ray being a native feature of the device. No breakout box with your HD DVD.
Yep.
You're going to be using Sony's Blu-ray standard. So Sony's making money on every single Xbox that's being Xbox One being sold. So that gives you something right there. Sony, I mean, I remember one of the things, and I was looking around for stuff back a few years ago. DaVinci was like, dude, you got to get that that PS3 because it's one of the best Blu-ray players around. Forget what else it does. It's one of the best Blu-ray players out there. It's really stable. It's one of the few ones that gets frequent updates.
It's,
you know,
it's my hardware. It's the only Blu-ray player that I have.
Right. Likewise. You only need one. Yeah. So Sony stole Xbox's launch on a lot of the hey, this is an entertainment console thing. Xbox has come back full force, and it's really going to be interesting to see which one is going to take over. I don't know which one I'd buy right now. In fact, I don't know so much that I'm going to have to agree with Andy a few weeks ago or last week when we were doing the 2 weeks ago when we were doing the Black Friday, what you're going to buy for Christmas special. I couldn't buy a console today because unless I wanted both of them, I couldn't choose between the two. And then there's the fact that I'm not trying to get rid of my current consoles because they still have content that I'm interested in.
Right.
So then you're stuck with four consoles under your thing. That stinks. When these guys can all get on the bandwagon of, hey, replace your PS3 with a PS4 and have all the functionality of your PS3 plus more, that's when I'll think about adding yet another plastic device that needs to be plugged in under my space. Right. But right now, I mean, think about it. If you've got two plugs coming out of your wall and you've got two UPSs coming out of those plugs, that's just a weird situation. You've got to put now four consoles in addition to, let's call it an Apple TV or an Ouya or whatever. Mm-hmm. Luckily, the Chromecast doesn't need any plugging in. But if you've got an antenna, that needs a plug today. If you've got any kind of converter boxes for your audio. If you've got speakers. If you've got an amp or receiver. All that stuff has to be plugged in. And they're just like, we want to put two more boxes under your thing. Oh, and we don't want to support the old stuff. That's why I'm waiting. That's a big reason why I'm waiting.
All right. Let's just to grab a couple more here. I can't remember. I think it's up to, your turn, Dwayne. You've got one last topic that you want to talk about, best tech story of 2013.
Yeah. I mean, it's not – it's definitely a top story. The iOS 7 changeover. Signified a lot of things for me. One of them was that iOS has seen what Android can do, and it's been very clear that iOS has been dragged kicking and screaming into, you know, every new version has been dragged kicking and screaming into new ways of functionality by Google's Android. Google's Android has driven the market in terms of the way the actual operating system allows users to customize and innovate and so on and so forth. So iOS 7 shows that they got rid of a lot of stuff. They got rid of a lot of the junk and they made the functionality tighter, control center, yada, yada, yada. But what it really shows me is that there's a changing of the guard at Apple, not unlike what we talked about with Steve Ballmer at Microsoft. There's a changing of the guard and it shows that, there's a new era of leadership in this really powerful tech company, the most powerful company in the world right now. They got rid of Forrestal, the guy who was in charge of the software and had amazing success throughout the early part of the century. And, you know, with Tim Cook and with Johnny Ive being in charge, they moved in a direction that I don't think Steve Jobs would have come to so quickly. You know, the wood paneling is gone. The skeuomorphism is gone. That's fine. That's great. Whatever. It's the gestures that are a new thing. It's no longer about let's find the right button and click back. It's about the fact that they want to move natively into the way these touchscreens work. Swiping this and swiping that gets you something instead of just looking for a button and tapping it. It's the way it works on the hood. It's the way, in some ways, it's not finished. You go to voice memos, for instance, and there's a label and then there's a button and they have the same term. You don't know which one to hit. You go to a couple other places and you begin to see where certain things just aren't completely complete, which is not something that we don't associate with Steve Jobs. But we know that this was rolled out in between 7 and 9 months, and it had to be that way. It's a fundamental change from the way business has been done before. But the fact of the matter is that there's a new guard at Apple, and iOS 7 is a way that Apple has, you know, tried to stay relevant in the face of mounting pressure from rivals like Samsung, which have really shown the world what can be done with a mobile phone.
You know, it's a hard thing to put your finger on. It is quite a drastic change, but I think it has wider implications than just iOS and Apple devices. I think a lot of organizations are now taking always take a cue from Apple in terms of what they think for look and feel and design, not just for apps they run on that platform, but also their own native apps. So I think it's a big change for the industry, and we'll see how it all plays out in the wash. Remember, iOS 7 I think is just the first small step. There's got to be a lot more to come if it's going to still be successful against the Google and the Samsungs of this world. It's an interesting move, and it's definitely, as you said, a new era, a new step, a new direction.
Yeah. And what do you think about this idea that when it comes to iOS 7, Apple's actually following Android instead of actually leading on the design?
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think that, you know, the nature of technological innovation is like that. It's not just one leader. We had Apple as the leader that everyone as the pace car that everyone sort of followed for a while. And Samsung allowed them enough sort of Samsung gained enough ground through ripping off Apple's own design, which, you know, they went to court with for about famously. But because of that, Apple had to play catch up, and now we're sort of in that cycle where Apple is playing a little catch up. People have been happy with some of the Android innovations, and they want that for their own iDevices as well. So Apple's had to sort of step up to the plate. I think this thing comes and goes in cycles. And now we're seeing the cycle where Apple is not the leader and they're the follower.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of nice to see that kind of a yin and yang.
Yeah.
I hope that it can be maintained. I like great rivals. You know, I mean, we're just talking about the consoles. I like the fact that those guys are going after one another. Everybody's in this fight to cut the cord. Google's in it, Apple's in it in their own way, you know, Microsoft and Sony's in it. So those kinds of rivalries, you know, it's a little bit more confusing, but I like that too. But we really need this Apple-Samsung situation to get the most out of both companies. Samsung needs more integration. Apple needs more innovation. And they're both driving each other that way.
Tosin, why don't you wrap up the list of the top news of 2013 with your last thing on your list here?
So the last thing on my list is Twitter. So Twitter IPO'd this year and ended up bringing in a whopping $2.1 billion. So actually raised more money than Facebook a year ago. And I think this is pretty big tech news because it's once again continuing that trend of large companies, well, of tech companies going public and being able to sustain it. Now, the question is, you know, what will happen in the future for Twitter? Will they be able to become positive? How will they generate revenue? You know, where does this take them now? And also the larger question, too, is as we continue to see larger and larger IPOs, it always makes you think back to the, you know, late 90s when there was that large crash, the whole tech bubble burst.
You just talked about Bitcoin and how it's been skyrocketing, hit $1 billion. Again, that's really straightforward, right? Here's currency. People like it. It's moving forward. I look at this age, because it's more than a year now, right? Instagram happened more than a year ago. This age of tech companies and their valuations. Instagram is definitely a little strange because its purchase was a private purchase, a public company buying a private company.
So it didn't like have to fight out on the market. Facebook was also interesting because it didn't have to fight out on the market. I mean, Facebook was interesting because it fell and then it rose. It kind of settled where it needed to settle. Twitter was a smarter IPO, as we talked about. It was more measured. It was I wouldn't say it was less ambitious, but it was certainly focused on whatever real measures they can get out of it. And I feel as if what we're seeing here is an appreciation for technology that hasn't existed. But we're also seeing a whole bunch of investors who are trying to chase the next big thing. Is it scalable? Does it have crazy mass market appeal? Can I get humongous amounts of data out of it? And if I can't, can I at least see the revenue model out the gate? You know, if I can't see the revenue model, I can get lots of data. I got that backward. If I can't see the revenue model, like in Twitter, I can at least get lots of data out of it. And while the data hasn't been figured out in terms of like how I can leverage it, it's going to happen. Someone's going to figure that out, and I need to be on the ground floor of this. I think that's really what it comes down to. It's not like the console discussion where it's like new hardware's come out and now we've got to figure out how to get the most out of it. It might take a couple years, but you know, I got to get on that. I think that's what's so great about what we were seeing with Twitter and stuff. Twitter is, I mean, it's a phenomenal resource. It's caused revolutions. It's a tool of, you know, great renown when it comes to the Arab Spring. So it's clear that Twitter's not nothing. It's clear that all that change is worth $1 billion at least, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Government's falling and toppling. But it is interesting because it's hard to see that cost, that financial value, where we know it's got social, political, and technological value. This is tricky stuff.
All right, we're going to take one last break here, but when we return, we're going to wrap up our top stories of 2013 list with a discussion of the top fails of 2013 and some predictions for 2014. So take a listen to this and come on back. I raise my flags, tie my clothes, never asking why. We rule the world. I try carrying the weight of the world. Those days are gone. Waking up to ashes, dust, ashes on the ground. I still hear the song. Life will pass me by if I don't open up my eyes. So that's fine by me. So wake me up when it's don't all over. Don't you worry, and I'm wiser and I'm older. Got a plan for all you. This time I was finding myself and I didn't know I was gone. And we'll never be wrong. You're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Anafowakan. So those were the top stories of 2013, the top successes, you could say. What would be some of the biggest fails of 2013?
Oh, man. Loaded question.
Yeah. I think the first one that I would want to mention is Microsoft's DRM on the Xbox One. You guys remember that catastrophe beginning of the year?
Oh, PR nightmare. I think we should lay it out for them, though. What happened?
So this in discussing the new console, or not discussing the new console, as Microsoft tended to not delve any information when asked mm-hmm. about it, we ultimately discovered that Microsoft was going to force users to always be online to play games. So you would have had to have an internet connection to even play a game, and put other stringent restrictions on selling games or even lending them for your friends to play. And this led to a huge uproar by both the media and people who, fans of games, fans of the you know, Xbox 360. There was even a Microsoft employee, and I cannot remember the name right now. We'll look that up for you. Who on Twitter? Do you guys remember that fiasco where someone?
The guy who said basically he said, "Tough, you know."
Yeah, deal with it.
Deal with it.
It wasn't Major Nelson, was it?
No, it wasn't
Major Nelson. This person, unfortunately, I believe, was actually let go.
Yes,
from Microsoft.
He was
as well, but it was just a huge fiasco.
He was such a problem that we've forgotten him. That's the hallmark of like a PR nightmare. Like you went and you said this nonsense on the internet, and the crowd said you need to go, and then you were forgotten.
Yep.
Yes. It was Adam Orth, Microsoft Studios creative director. And he tweeted, "Sorry, I don't get the drama around having an always-on console. Every device is always on. That's the world we live in. Hashtag deal with it."
Yeah. So quite a fail by Microsoft. Now, they've tried to make amends and they, you know, have this whole thing about, hey, we've listened to the fans and we are changing our policy. But I think it still stings. It still hurts pretty deep down to know that, you know, this initial thing, be it maybe forced by the publishers, maybe not, but it was a very concerning thing for those who were really interested in that console. And quite frankly, it gave a lot of upswing to the PlayStation and to what Sony was offering, and could potentially, for some of the really, for the people who follow that story, is kind of a piece that may sway them in what they choose to purchase. I know it definitely affected me and what I was planning to purchase back then.
Something else, another fail of 2013?
I mean, RIM?
RIM, Research and
Motion.
Well,
I mean, RIM has been a fail for the last 5 years.
Yes.
But they hit a new level of failure in 2013.
Yeah, RIM rebranded themselves as BlackBerry and said, hey, they were going to change how things were run. They released a brand new device.
Right.
And now we see them kind of falling to pieces in terms of, you know, losing out employees to Apple, who's setting up shop next door to try and recruit people, as well as just having to change leadership and potentially looking to sell.
Yeah, I mean, The big thing there is that RIM did what everyone thought they should do for a long time, like consolidate your leadership. And let's also just do stuff like, why are you called RIM? You make one product. You're not that multifaceted organization anymore. Right. You really need to lock it down and consolidate that brand message of BlackBerry, because that's what you have. And then on top of all that, it's, okay, you're gonna, like, you know, get rid of the two CEOs and get to the normal CEO and yada yada yada, and it's kind of like there's a lot of too little, too late going on here, and that's an issue.
Yep. Moving on, another fail, Nintendo. So in this year of 2013, where we had these a console war, we had two major players, Sony and Microsoft, bringing consumers the next generation in console gaming, Nintendo rested on its laurels. And it's not even fair to say resting on its laurels, because that would assume that they rested at a high point. The last time Nintendo offered something for a next generation console was the Wii U, which was last year. And the Wii U wasn't even close to the Wii U was still the of an older technology, so they hadn't even gotten to the point where they were caught up to the PS4 or the PS3 or the Xbox 360. And so Nintendo, in response to the call this year to refresh consoles, Nintendo did absolutely nothing. And in fact, I mean, other than just sort of having new Nintendo property games like Super Mario Brothers, Nintendo has no sort of new innovation at all, either in the present or in the near future. As far as they can see, they're kind of at a stalemate.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really tough one for Nintendo. They've been doing more in the handheld market, but when it comes to like the stay at home console, they've really suffered. I mean, apart from their own titles, if you recall earlier this year, I believe it was in May, where EA, so Electronic Arts, said that they were no longer going to be developing anything for Wii U. So all their sports titles or anything else would not be coming to Wii U. And I actually even believe one of the developers called out the Wii U as like being a terrible, terrible machine.
Yeah, I mean, I feel these echoes of the Dreamcast, the off year refresh.
Yeah.
The idea that if we get first to market, we'll get all everyone's attention. But this gaming crowd is savvy, and they're looking for the best thing, and they're willing to wait a little while not to have the first thing, just like with telephones, just like with tablets. So I think, you know, Nintendo messed up there. I mean, the Wii was an interesting device because it did a lot of what Sony and Microsoft wanted. Let's open up the market. Let's get non-gamers into it. But it didn't really attract hardcore gamers because the graphics technology was not up to par with the you know, Xbox 360 and the PS3. The Wii U is showing that again in a big ways. The screen-based controller is not a touchscreen, right? In an age of touchscreen, you've got that. You know, you've got the fact
so many reasons.
It's you know, Nintendo's always done its own thing. They've always marched to the beat of their own drum, and that's worked well for them in the past. And we want that to work well. PS Move was an interesting failure, seemingly failure, at least from my perspective, on the Sony front, where Kinect worked really well. But those guys had to go, you know, Microsoft and Sony had to go back to the drawing board to figure out how to effectively compete with this motion-based technology that Nintendo jumped on and made so neat and awesome. I think the Wii U was an opportunity for them to jump in at the level of a Microsoft, at the level of a PlayStation, with phenomenal hardware, and bring that innovative motion-based control to the gaming space. And I think most of us, if not all of us, are disappointed that they were not able to pull that off. They were not able to do that.
Yeah, it's a shame. Shame. I'd hate to see the end of Microsoft. I'm sorry, the end of Nintendo in this respect. I'd love to see them really surprise people. But I think, as we've discussed it on the show before, that's not Nintendo's mentality as a corporate entity.
I mean, even when it came to online, you know, network play, do you guys remember with the Wii, you had to have like that 12 or 16 digit code in order to, instead of just like a login and a username?
Your
Mii
code, your MII code.
Yeah, exactly. It's just kind of like, part of it's like, in order to pull off that innovation, you need to do it, but then you need to be different. But then part of it's like, how come the user experience is so jarring in many ways? So, their founder, just like Apple, just like Microsoft, their founder is no longer present in the day-to-day operation. In fact, he just passed away. And because of that, they're trying to figure out their next moves. Or at least not their founder, but the guy who took them from a gaming, a card gaming company into a technological gaming company is no longer with them. So they've got to figure out how to exist past that. They've got to do either Kingmaker style Tim Cook layout or post Steve Ballmer committee style, you know, Holy Roman Empire, elect a new person kind of layout in order to find the right way to manage that company. Because what's happening now isn't working.
Right. I would say, as far as big fails, the NSA failed in locking their data up and allowing Edward Snowden to steal it.
Yeah, this is number two in our top five failures, I would say. It's a big freaking failure.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, you got this guy running around telling us how the most free country in the world is in fact a lot less free than you think it is when it comes to the electronic data and how people are using them and the privacy and everything. That's not good. That is terrible.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you're like, okay, government who wants to be so secure that they're collecting all this data and using it to keep us secure, how the heck did this get out in the first place? And there you have the biggest, you know, one of the biggest fails of 2013, right? Like,
yep.
Like, huge fail. Yeah. How did this happen? How did you let this, you know, virtually, you know, he comes across as a youngster. How did you let him grab all this data and run away with it?
This is an organization whose sole purpose is the collection of data and keeping it secret. The national security, and you have one of the biggest breaches in possibly the most historically biggest breaches in American history.
Yeah, because this is not the kind of stuff that, you know, in 20 years' time we would be like, all right, let's get the Freedom of Information Act on, let's see what's going on. This stuff was supposed to stay in the vault forever.
Yeah,
this stuff was not supposed to get out. And the people screening Snowden or whomever simply forgot or did not pay attention to or profile the private contractors working here. And
I think that's what it was.
Yeah, yeah. Or at least they didn't keep track of the fact, hey, have you noticed that this data over here is or these files that were copied? Oh, who copied them? I don't know. The Snowden guy? Oh, I wonder what he's doing with them. Whatever. I mean, maybe that's what happened. But the fact is, it was not seen. They were blindsided.
Dwayne,
and that's not good.
Dwayne, what would you consider the biggest fail of 2013?
Yeah. So, I mean, the biggest fail of 2013, I think, all in all, is the fall of Nokia. You know, like when you look at when you watch a great movie like Lord of the Rings, or you read a book like Chronicles of Prydain or something like that, you see these great civilizations rise and fall and so on. Like what's it called? George R. R. Martin's Game of Thrones series, A Song of Ice and Fire.
Sure.
Right?
Westeros,
you know, like the Red Keep. It fell to Robert, you know, from the Targaryens, things like that.
Yeah.
Nokia has fallen. After 140 plus years, Nokia has taken its biggest hit by losing its telecom sector, its telecom division to Microsoft.
Founded in 1865.
Founded in 1865, paper mill company. Moved into electricity production, moved into telecom in the 1990s, reinvented telecom with stole the crown from Motorola, basically, and reinvented the cell phone. It did to the cell phone what Apple did to the MP3 player. It took it global. And for, you know, more than, you know, for about 20 years, they were really running the cell phone industry. They were the biggest cell phone maker in the world. They had cell phones everywhere. And then somehow in the mid-2000s, they made a strategic decision that failed them. This decision was, look, we're not going to focus on the super fancy next-gen technology. We're going to focus on the emerging world, these BRIC countries, and we're going to put cell phones in the hands of every single person living there. And, you know, it did work. All these people have cell phones. You transfer money with cell phones. There are no hard lines when you go to, like, parts of Africa. It's all cell phones, but the margins were not there. And even those people started jumping over to technologies by, you know, companies like ZTE in Hawaii that could offer these great smartphone technologies at a completely low price, especially with the release of Android being free and not being a licensed operating system. These smaller companies can jump in and create Android devices that people want and that they can afford. You know, Nokia did not follow suit. They stuck with their MeeGo operating system and their Symbian operating system, which was the big their mainstay for like 20 years. Right. Symbian.
Right.
They failed
stubbornly hung on to those.
Stubbornly,
systems.
They said we are the big dog here, and Symbian is relevant. And then when that didn't work, they ran into the arms of Microsoft, and they said, "Hey, buddy, hey Microsoft, hey, can we link up here? You've got this new Windows Phone thing. We've got the biggest distribution in the world. Let's get your Windows Phone devices into people's hands." And it seemed like a match made in heaven, but it did not work. People did not pick up the Windows Phone devices. Good devices that, had they been released 5 years ago, would really be strong in the marketplace. But the thing is, the ecosystems have been built. And putting a 41-megapixel camera on your Windows Phone wasn't going to move people over. At the end of the day, Nokia took its telephone division and it sold it to Microsoft, who can currently afford to buy it. And, you know, after, you know, it was attrition. Workers laid off, you know, software engineers being removed. And then finally now, this year, 2013, it was over. Nokia gave up its biggest piece of its company, this crazy long tradition of technology, of Europe leading in mobile technology, to Microsoft, which has shown us, as we discussed, that it is not exactly a leader when it comes to mobile technology. So, ladies and gentlemen, Nokia has fallen. It's like the fall of Rome.
Who's fiddling?
The fall of Finland, really, if you want to get specific.
Yeah, well, I mean, in terms of like the space, it's like, sure. You know, these guys were the guys who ran it for as long as we could remember. And then they fell. Luckily, we're not in dark ages. We're in some sort of renaissance.
Yeah.
But it's definitely the landscape has changed. Nokia is responsible for the SIM card. Nokia is responsible for GSM. You know?
That's right.
That's how right. big they are or were. They're responsible for these technologies. They did them on their own. They were like, we don't want to listen to what the world wants. We want to do this, and this the world will do as we say. What's good for Nokia is good for telecom. That's what happened. And maybe we have a sign on there. What's good for GM is good for America. What's good for Nokia is good for telecom. Look where these companies are now. GM just gained its independence back from the taxpayer this last weekend. So yeah, this is a cautionary tale. It doesn't matter how big you are, you need to innovate. You don't need to chase your tail, but you need to innovate. You need to stay current. You need to know where the world is headed.
That's a good place to end that discussion. And before we wrap up our best of 2013 discussion in general, I want to just go around the table here and ask you guys what your predictions are for 2014. What are we going to see next year? I'll start with you, Dwayne.
I think we're going to see improved wearable tech. I don't know if Apple's going to come out with a watch or anything like that. I don't think that that's necessary to see improved wearable tech. Everything's so interesting. You know, these embedded technology solutions are powerful. They're low on power. You've got Bluetooth low energy. My cats each wear a Fitbit, so I can tell how many steps they're taking to make sure that they are active enough during the day. I think we're going to see way more in terms of this embeddable technology into our everyday lives. And I think that's going to be really interesting. And I'm excited to see what happens when it comes to things like Google Glass or sport goggles or GoPro.
Tosin, how about yourself? What are your predictions for 2014?
So this might actually be similar to a prediction I had last year, but I think that this is probably going to be, you know, the year of the cloud, and that's a very large statement. So that's cloud in terms of storage, in terms of computing, also in terms of gaming and storing your game files. I think cloud is definitely here to stay and is going to have a overwhelmingly huge presence next year, especially given, you know, what may happen to several large organizations out there. So I think you saw the beginning of the shift to the cloud, and I think this coming year you're going to see the dominance of the cloud.
Oh, the cloud storage guy said it's going to be the year of the cloud? Okay.
The dominance of the cloud.
Okay. Okay. I think the year of the cloud was 2011, really. I think that's when the cloud as a concept ascended. That's it. But if you're changing it by saying it's the year, the dominance of the cloud, I think every year is going to be dominated by the cloud from now on. I mean, who wants local anything, right?
That's true, but I think it's going to come into – I think you're going to hear and see a lot more of it, be it in your game consoles and just how you work every day. I think it's going to be more prevalent, especially with a lot of organizations. I think this is when they
With organizations, says the guy who works for the leading company of cloud services for organizations. Okay. Okay. All right.
Oh, my. All right. As for me, just to sort of reiterate some of the things that I said during the main part of our discussion, I think that Amazon is about to be a tech leader on par with Google, Apple, and Microsoft. Google, Apple, and Microsoft have sort of dominated. They've been the triumvirate for the last 2 or 3 years now. And Amazon, I think we had underestimated Amazon up until this point, but I think that is about to end. And Jeff Bezos's leadership is going to bring Amazon into the forefront and be a major competitor, a major tech force, along with Google, Apple, and Microsoft. We talked about the innovation in media with the Amazon Instant Video. We've talked about the Amazon drones, Prime Air, logistics. I think they're going to be a force to be reckoned with.
I think Jeff Bezos is going to become a name that is synonymous with technology and innovation in a way it hasn't been before. Mm-hmm. You hear the name Bezos, you're like, oh, who's he? Oh, he's an Amazon guy. Oh, yeah, he must be cool. That's kind of how it is right now. Whereas you hear Sergey, you hear Tim Cook. These are names that are in the mainstream media, and Jeff Bezos just got there. Granted, part of it was through this book that doesn't give him put him in the best light. But, you know, through 60 Minutes, through whatever, Jeff Bezos has been undercover almost in the tech space since Amazon launched in 1990s. I think, you know, 1995 or 6 or whatever. So I think we're going to see his face more, hopefully, and see him as the public face of Amazon and get to know him and get to like him, honestly. So I think there's something there.
Yeah. He's a likable guy. He's got a very infectious laugh, if nothing else.
You can't be who he is without being a likable guy, right? That's one of the cool things about the guys who run tech, and, at least today.
You know, in the wake of like Bill Gates leaving Microsoft, Steve Ballmer leaving Microsoft, Steve Jobs departing and leaving the company to Tim Cook, we still have a company. Amazon is still a company that is run by its founder.
I know. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. I think legacies maybe cement themselves after the passing of the founder, like they found and then people express. But I do know that Jeff Bezos is he's a guy who has so many things he wants to accomplish that I think he actually deserves to be sitting up there with Elon Musk in terms of vision and wherewithal. I mean, he also did just buy the Washington Post, so we will be seeing him in 2014 as a media force. What he chooses to do with it will be very interesting. Jeff Bezos is I think that if we had to have a man of the year, or not to call it a man, a person of the year for the drill down, I think it'd be a hard choice between Edward Snowden and Jeff Bezos.
I'm going to give it to Edward Snowden this year, but next year it's going to go to Jeff Bezos.
Okay. All right. I would say that I would give it to Edward Snowden with Jeff Bezos being the runner-up. In fact, I think Times Magazine of the Year as the Pope. I mean, Pope Francis is great.
Yeah, yeah.
But Edward Snowden really kind of
But what has Pope Francis really done for tech this year?
Oh, yeah. He hasn't done much for tech.
Okay. So let's close this off. I'm going to go around the table, start with you, Dwayne. Where can we find your work on the internet when you're not here on the drill down?
You can always find me on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD. That's Dwayned. And you can always find me on flavors.me, flavors.me/DwayneD, where you can see kind of an aggregated presence of what I'm thinking, what I'm doing.
Tosin, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321, and you can also find other ramblings at ircwebcast.blogspot.com.
As for myself, you can find me at mrbabyman.com and Twitter and Facebook and all the other social media outlets at mrbabyman. You can find The Drill Down at thedrilldown.com. If you get an idea for a story you think we should be talking about on The Drill Down, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you have a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. You can let The Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. Now, next week, we're going to have one more show this year. And Tosin, I think you're going to be gone, so it's going to be myself and Dwayne. And we might have someone else in. We might have Greg Davies in. And then I think that's it for 2013, because we won't be recording a show on Christmas or New Year's Day, which is the Wednesdays following next week. And then we'll pick it up again in the new year. Until then, that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.
Happy Hanukkah.
Happy
belated Hanukkah.
Happy holidays. Happy Hanukkah. Holidays.
Joyous Yule.
Happy Festivus.
Pop Danthology.
Bigger, better, stronger, power. Throw it up, throw it up. Watch it all fall out. Throw it up, throw it up. That's how we fall out.